All right, welcome to today's podcast, today's Q&A podcast with Metabolic Effect. I'm Dr. Jade Tita. We do these podcasts for our community and live calls for our lifestylers. If you'd like to submit your call, you can text the word Met Effect to 38470, or you can send an email to support at Metabolic Effect and put a question for Jade in the subject line. We're going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot of questions to get to. Typically I'm going to let these things run about 30 minutes. I know people don't want to be on the call for hours. I usually get complaints about that. So let's see how many calls or how many questions we can get through. First question says, I'm reading Dr. Jade's book, The New Me Diet. I'm a sugar burner. In his dietary recommendations for sugar burners, he recommends water, skim milk, unsweetened almond milk, and coconut water for making smoothies. He specifically states no coconut milk. Why? I'm allergic to dairy and almond and make my own coconut milk with organic unsweetened coconut flakes and water. Also, if I really need to avoid coconut milk, can I make another nut milk besides almond? Thank you. All right, so this person is probably relatively new to Metabolic Effect, and I always appreciate these questions. Our first book, The Metabolic Effect Diet, it was released in hardcover first, called The New Me Diet. This is oftentimes a confusing topic for people because they're like, which book? The first book we released was released under hardcover as The New Me Diet, and it then got released later as paperback as The Metabolic Effect Diet. Same book. One was the hardcover, The New Me Diet. Next one was the paperback, The Metabolic Effect Diet. Now, when we wrote this book, obviously, when you write a program for the masses, you have to have some structure to it. You must have some structure. And of course, people who are, this being our first diet book, we needed to have sort of distill things down into what people did best with in these individual categories. Of course, if you actually read that book, you'll find that the whole point is to give you an idea about how your metabolism works by assigning you a category and then having you adjust your approach to get the perfect fit for you. And of course, we expand on that in our second book called Lose Weight Here. So the point here is that really, while you may get the idea from reading the book that you can only have certain foods, if you read further, you'll actually see that once you get started, that's just the structure, and then we want you to get flexible. So in reality, you can have anything you want so long as it works for you. But let's take a step back and say, why for a sugar burner would we want to avoid fat, right? We're talking about water and skim milk and unsweet almond milk. So we're really trying to take out the fat and the sugar and have as little of this sort of as possible. But of course, when you really get into this, if you're really paying attention, coconut water, you know, if we're really trying to eliminate sugar, coconut water has some sugar in it. And so the question here then becomes down into semantics and how much we want to sort of control these things. The idea behind this, the reason why we said no coconut milk, because coconut milk traditionally, now it's changed a little bit since the release of that book, was a full fat product. It was very heavy in fat. Now we have coconut milks that are relatively low fat. And for a sugar burner, we really don't want to have a whole lot of extra calories going into a protein shake. That's what really it was about. We wanted relatively low calorie, water being best, something like unsweetened almond milk, skim milk. These are pretty low calorie, low carb, and low fat. And that was the idea there, trying to get the most hunger suppressing, craving suppressing bang for our buck without the calories. However, that being said, if you want to add these things to your shake and they make a difference in terms of palatability, in terms of your personal preferences, and control hunger, energy, and cravings, keep your heck in check, then absolutely do it. The point here, though, is that what many people do, and this is sort of a larger question, to stick with your question just about can you have coconut milk, absolutely you can, okay? You absolutely can. Our suggestion, though, for sugar burners is that you keep your protein shakes low calorie, relatively low sugar first, and also low fat. In other words, don't make your protein shakes these 700, 800 calorie shakes that many people do. Try to keep them higher in protein, higher in fiber, lower in fat, and lower in carbs. And that way you'll get more hunger suppressing, craving suppressing bang for your buck, and typically get better results. What many people will do is they'll take this idea, and this is important for everybody who's listening to this podcast, is they get confused with what is healthy and what works for fat loss. And of course, if you have weight to lose, excess weight, you're trying to lose fat, the healthiest thing you can do for your body is lose that fat. But what many people will be is like, oh, I heard coconut oil and coconut fat and avocado fat and nuts and seeds and all that is good for me. And it may be, but it has nothing to do with the fact that it may not support weight loss or fat loss, especially if it's very high calorie. So we have to prioritize this. If you're wanting to get healthier and you're overweight, the best way you can do that is to lose the fat. And then secondarily, you can start choosing foods that are also, you know, healthy, have vitamins and minerals and good fats and things like that. But your priority is to lose fat. And there are plenty of good, healthy foods that don't include a hefty dose of fat and or sugar, which coconut milk, as healthy as it might be, does provide a pretty hefty amount of calories, unless you're getting these low-fat versions now that they have at the store, or you're making your own, that could be fine as well. What I do want to avoid is what people do where they're like, oh, I'll put avocado in my shake. Oh, and I heard that yogurt's good, so I'll put full-fat Greek yogurt in there. Oh, and I'll put some flaxseed in there. Oh, and I'll add some extra coconut oil in there. Next thing they know, they're drinking this shake because they're trying to get all this healthy elements in it, and the shake goes from a 300-calorie shake that is hunger-suppressing, energy balancing and craving suppressing and helps lose fat to a 700, 800 calorie shake that's also hunger and energy and craving suppressing, but does not help them lose fat. And so that's the point there. So to make it a more simple answer for you, add whatever you want in your shakes. The first priority is, does it keep your hunger, energy, and cravings in check? Does it keep heck in check? If it does, great, use it. Second thing is, does it also help you manage your calories and lose fat? If it does, wonderful. Okay. So hopefully that makes sense and answers that question for you. Okay. Hey, Jade, I've got chilblains and get frostbite even though I'm at home keeping warm. Please, can you advise how I can best manage this? I also have Raynaud's. It basically paralyzes me as the cold saps my energy and mood badly. Yeah, this is going to be one of those things that's going to be lifestyle oriented in general. So there's not going to be a whole lot that you can do here, although we can talk about some of the things that will increase blood flow. And let's talk a little bit about that. Things that you can do that may theoretically have an effect on this. The first thing that you want to do is you want to make sure that you're not exposing your body to sort of extreme cold, and that you're sort of warming your body up ahead of time and then making sure you're wearing gloves and a hat and all those kinds of things, all those sort of simple things. But then there are also things that you can do that increase blood flow and are good for the capillaries. Let's cover some of those. Cocoa is a very good one to do. It is very helpful in that regard. So are sort of spicy, and hot foods can be very good in that regard. Ginkgo biloba, vitamin E, these are other things that you can do. And of course, exercise as well is one of these things. But anyone who's dealing with these issues knows how difficult this is. There's not much in the way of research or clinical experience that can be done about this. And it's one of these conditions that is kind of sort of waxes and wanes and is tough to deal with clinically. Another thing you could theoretically try is you can, be using contrast hydrotherapy also to try to get these capillary beds to behave more appropriately. But Raynaud's is not well understood. And for those of you who are listening to Raynaud's, there's Raynaud's disease and Raynaud's syndrome. And typically Raynaud's disease, it sounds like the worst thing, but it's actually relatively benign. Raynaud's syndrome typically comes along with other conditions. And so one of the things you want to do is screen yourself for autoimmune conditions and those kinds of things, as this typically comes along with this. Contrast hydrotherapy, altering hot and cold to the body, can oftentimes have a positive impact on the reactivity as well. And so those of you who don't know what that is, you can easily do this in a shower. You can also do it with your hands. And what you're going to do is you go 3 minutes in hot water, sort of 10 seconds to 30 seconds in cold water. Obviously, a cold blast of water on the whole body if you're doing this, and this is what I suggest in the shower, 10 seconds is enough. It'll literally take the breath out of you. So what you do is you go hot, 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 and then you go a cold blast, and you do hot, and then you do cold, and you do hot, and then you do cold. And you always want to end in cold, and this can have a positive effect on this. So these are the things I would try. Sorry, I don't have more to give you here. As you know, this is sort of tough to deal with. You also may want to try some other things that, you know, some people talk about potentially being helpful. Curcumin is, you know, one that I've heard some people say, but I have to be honest with you, I've been not very successful in helping people deal with this. And if you go online, there's not a whole lot that can be done either. So sorry, I'm not too helpful in that regard. Next question. I'm going to start training for a half marathon that's going to take place in 3 months and would like your advice as on what time of weight training or what type of weight training is best for me, traditional with long rests or metabolic conditioning. I'm around 30 pounds overweight and hope to shed some of that weight during my training. Although I know that cardio of this type is not optimal for fat burning, I'm aiming for 3 weeks of EMEM times 1 week of ELEL during this period. Thank you. Okay, so this is a question about someone who is doing one of these marathon running programs. Obviously, back in the 90s, these were really, really popular for weight loss. And I've seen these things not be very effective at all for weight loss, which is really interesting, right? Because they were so popular, but they really didn't have a great effect, because what would happen was people would begin running and they also began eating more. And that's one of the things we talk a lot about here in Metabolic Effect, is that steady state, long duration exercise can, and actually I would say in most people who are not fit. Now, we're not talking about runners who run. There are people who have gravitated towards this type of activity because it suits them. And that's one of the things we'll say here about exercise. We typically like to think that, you know, people look a certain way because they exercise a certain way. And that's true sometimes. But the more likely thing that has occurred is that someone who is naturally predisposed to something chooses that activity. In other words, you know, if you take somebody like myself, who's a big, bulky, muscular guy, when I first started, you know, sort of getting fit, I was young. My dad put me into soccer. I hated it. He put me into football. I loved it. Why? Because I was naturally predisposed genetically to some degree to be a short sprinter and very strong and was not very endurance oriented, and vice versa. One of the ways I've heard this described is by several people. They use Lance Armstrong as sort of an example here. Now, he's kind of had a falling from grace, but the idea would be that Lance Armstrong does not look the way he does because he rides a bike, but rather he rides a bike because he looks the way he does. That's one way to look at this, and just something I want to talk about here, because this is what we typically do. We'll be like, oh, look at these marathon runners who are, you know, running around and these super fit people at the top of their field. Well, these are athletes, and they probably chose that activity because it naturally suited their lean lines and lean physique and sort of endurance capacity. And so you don't want to fall into the trap of thinking that, oh, I'm going to train this way to look this way. It doesn't usually work that way. So especially for people who are overweight, trying to take up marathon running and running, Very few of them. I have known a handful of them in my career, but very, very few people do I know have taken up endurance activity, lost the weight by using it, and kept it off. I know very, very few people that way. So let's talk about this goal then. Is it healthy? Absolutely. And is there a way that you can turn this into better results for yourself? Absolutely. And you've already got some of the, a good sort of handle on this, meaning that if you start combining weight training with this activity, what you're going to be able to do is you're going to be able to slow or possibly even halt, and maybe if you're a complete beginner, even gain some muscle while you're doing this. The natural consequence of doing this for most people is that you lose some fat, yes, but you lose some muscle also, and you trigger hunger and energy and craving responses that make it so that you will sort of rebound in, sort of your weight loss if you lose any. But adding weight training in keeps the muscle on you. And so what happens is you don't get so much of this metabolic compensation or are less likely to regain the weight later. Now that you're doing this exercise, what is the best type of weight training to maintain and gain muscle? It's traditional weight training with long rests, 4 sets of 10 reps of different exercises, right? So let's go through this. Here's how I would do this. If I was doing this, I would say, all right, so you're going to run, 3 to 4 times per week, maybe. And then I would say you probably want to do weight training 2 to 3 times per week on top of that. And that should be traditional weight training. And the way I like to do this is make it very simple for you. Do a squat, do a bench press, do a bent over row, and do a shoulder press. 4 sort of movements, and then do 4 to 5 sets of 10 repetitions using a 10 rep max, meaning a weight that is, you can do 10 times, but not 11. And typically when you find this 10 rep max, you're going to be in the 8 to 12 rep range. So if you're getting fewer than 8 repetitions of the weight that you chose, you want to go up in weight. If you're getting more than 12, you want to go down in weight. So there is a little bit of a trick here. And that particular workout, because you're doing sort of a full body workout, you can do that 2 to 3 times per week along with the running, and you might get some better results. Okay, you might get some better results. The other thing you're going to want to look at is during this time, you're going to want to ramp up your protein intake and your fiber intake and be very careful about the hunger, energy, and craving issues. And so you're going to want to deal with that. And so you want to make sure you're not over eating, and this should help. Metabolic conditioning is probably going to be too, stressful for the body. It is cardiovascular in nature. It typically doesn't get the weights heavy enough, but you might want to do one of those, and fool around with it. It is about what works for you, but the best approach here is going to be a traditional weight training along with the running and watching your diet. You should do pretty well. So hopefully that is helpful. All right, next question. I have a question about what is needed to have a healthy cardiovascular system when cardiovascular disease runs in the family. For instance, my dad and brother lived a healthy lifestyle, but both had a heart attack at age 50, followed by surgeries for defibrillator, ablations, and bypass surgery. Presently, I am 47 years old, female, with a body fat of 25% and lift weights. In the past 6 months, I have reduced my cardio to just weightlifting. Any thoughts about the steps needed for a healthy cardiovascular system? All right. So here's the interesting thing. So frustrating, isn't it? Because when you look at the cardiovascular system, right, and you look at when we talk about that, we're talking about essentially all the arteries and veins and the heart and the lungs, but mainly the heart and the blood vessels. When we say cardiovascular, heart, cardiovascular, blood vessels. And what typically happens is we get plaques building up either on the inside of the wall or sort of in between the walls of these arteries that lead and supply blood to the heart. And then that can cause heart issues. Now, here's the interesting thing about this. What we do know is we do know that exercise certainly provides a benefit here. However, it does not, as you've alluded to, protect you completely from this. As a matter of fact, we have many, many stories of people who are runners and things like that who are out running and end up dropping dead. Even people, one of the most famous people who've written books, back in the day, and his name is, sort of escaped me now, died of a heart attack. And so this idea that cardiovascular exercise is going to be the only thing that protects against cardiovascular disease is wrong. Although it is protective, that we do know it is protective. So it's good that you do some. However, you can go overboard with this. And then we have to ask the question, well, how is it that people who are doing this stuff are still having heart attacks? Are there other things involved? Absolutely, there are. There is dietary stuff involved. And so you want to be eating a nutritious, anti-inflammatory based diet with plenty of phytonutrients, plant chemicals. What would that type of diet look like? Well, typically, and this is, people have begun to sort of distort this a little bit, but here's what we do know. A plant-based diet, and by plant-based diet, I mean mainly fruits and vegetables with, relatively low-fat animal products is still, now there's some debate about this, is still in a relatively low-carb diet, is still probably the best diet that we have in terms of the evidence base. Even though that some of these high fat diets have gotten popular, it doesn't mean the evidence base actually supports them. And so you really want to be eating probably something more along the lines of a paleo based diet, which would be lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, more vegetables than fruits, a small amount of sort of tubers and things like that, sweet potatoes, potatoes, things like that, but small amounts of that, and lean protein sources. You know, deer, elk, wild game tend to be very lean compared to animals that are livestock animals, you know, so that's important. And then the other part here is the stress component, which is probably the part that has perhaps some of the best evidence against it. Are for it rather, but we don't know a whole lot about it. In other words, we do know stressful lifestyles, lonely lifestyles, those kinds of things predispose also and elevate risk. And so what I'm saying here is it's not just cardiovascular exercise, it's going to be diet and it's going to be sort of stress management. And probably the biggest thing you can do is look at the learned sort of behaviors and passed down behaviors besides diet in the family. Let me explain that again. So oftentimes we tend to think when we look at our family, we're like, oh, I inherited these genes. But we also inherit, for lack of a better word, some many different ways of living. We inherit the way we deal with stress, and we inherit some emotional patterns and all of these kind of things. And we don't really inherit them, but we learn them. So they're learned responses. And so one of the things you want to do is you want to sort of look and see and basically say, okay, you know, what is it that my family does? And what are the patterns and, things that I see in the way they handle emotions and the way they connect and the way they eat and the way they exercise that I can begin looking and exploring and seeing if there are sort of different ways to do this. So that's another thing here. The other piece of this is you want to be as evidence-based as you can, which means that I would be exploring blood labs. Now, let's go through this a little bit too, because what we used to think is that it was all about cholesterol, right? Oh, high cholesterol, and you're going to drop dead of a heart attack. But now we know people who have heart attacks and, issues with heart, 50% of them have, normal to low cholesterol levels. So then we started looking at, some other things like total cholesterol to HDL ratios and things like C-reactive protein and homocysteine and triglyceride levels and fasting insulin and all of these things. And you can go to metaboliceffect.com. Actually, let me look up while I'm here. To get blood labs done, I'm going to just type this in and make sure I give you guys the right URL. But Metabolic Effect works with directlabs.com, and they will, and we have a whole panel that we recommend that you do. So if you go to directlabs.com/metabolic effect, you at the very least want to begin getting some of these panels done, the ones that Metabolic Effect recommends, and you can order them for yourself right online. And there's also some cardiovascular tests on here as well. And when you go to this page, I'm on this page right now, and you can look at some specialty tests. And some of these tests can be pretty important, especially stuff like the Berkeley Heart Lab test or the VAP test. In other words, you want to do more comprehensive testing on the cardiovascular system and be looking at certain things related to not just total cholesterol, but also LDL and HDL particle size and other parameters to get a full sort of understanding of your cardiovascular risk. And so that's another piece there that we want to, make sure you understand. And while I'm here, I'll actually tell you some of these tests that would be, good test to do. There's one test here called the Cardio Plus test. And this is one that sort of will give you, sort of the general overall thing that most doctors will give you, plus a little bit extra. And as I look down here, you can see tests like C-reactive protein, homocysteine. These are things that you might want to add on to your test if you are dealing with cardiovascular concerns. This is another thing that you'll want to look at. But what I would do is be looking at a full sort of cardiovascular panel. And here's the testing that I would get done and ask your doctor about in addition to what they normally do. You probably want to get a homocysteine. You also want to get a high sensitivity C-reactive protein, a fasting insulin level, and probably a hemoglobin A1C. And then you're going to want to probably be looking at getting particle sizes done, okay? And probably, ask your doctor about, some of the apolipoproteins as well. You can easily just tell your doctor, look, I want a full sort of understanding based on all the current knowledge about what my risks are. And if you see any of these things sort of elevated, you have the opportunity to begin to deal with this. The other thing to understand, by the way, too, is hypothyroid, which I deal with, is also a risk factor in itself for cardiovascular disease. So you want to rule out hypothyroid as well. Now, in terms of what can you do, and the reason I'm spending time on this is because it's probably, obviously it's one of our number one killers, if not the number one killer in the Western world, is cardiovascular disease. And this is the first time I think anyone's really asked about it. So I'm going to spend probably the rest of the time going through it. A couple other things here is that my brother Keone has been posting on Metabolic Effect lately about how some new research suggests the statin drugs possibly involved with, some deleterious brain effects. The other thing we now know is that statins, we used to think that statins worked based on the fact that they lowered cholesterol. But what now we know they're probably working if they work, for cardiovascular disease reduction through anti-inflammatory effects. However, we have many natural anti-inflammatories. One good book to read, by the way, and I'll look this up just to make sure I give you the right one, is my good friend, Johnny Bowden, who is a good friend of mine and an excellent nutritionist and doctor. He wrote a book called, I think it's called The Cholesterol Myth. Let me see. And it's a really great book for you to, it's called The Great Cholesterol Myth. Why lowering your cholesterol won't prevent heart disease and statin-free plan that will. This is an excellent book. It was printed back in November 1st, 2012, with Johnny Bowden and then Steven Sinatra, who I believe is a cardiologist. So that's a book that I would get if you haven't read that, all of you who are worried about this. The Cholesterol Myth, while lowering your cholesterol won't prevent heart disease and the statin-free plan that will. But going back to my point about anti-inflammatories, well, curcumin is one really great one that is, a really nice anti-inflammatory. And there are others as well. Cocoa powder, not chocolate, because chocolate has fat and sugar in it, but cocoa powder has been shown to do many, many things that will lower the risk of cardiovascular disease, including lowering blood pressure, increasing blood flow to the heart and to the blood vessels and things like that. And in a very simple way, magnesium as well, because high blood pressure is another one of those very easy risks to mitigate. Magnesium is a really good supplement to be taking, as it's involved in many, many processes and helps contraction of the heart, also helps lower blood pressure. So these are things that you can be thinking of and hopefully be dealing with, and understand that this is really about diet, yes, certainly about exercise, probably very much about stress management. And then one other thing I'll say, it's also about understanding your risk, which is why I went through the blood labs with you. And then it's also understanding that, the inflammatory state of the body can be dealt with, not necessarily just by drugs, but by many natural compounds, curcumin being one, fish oil being another, and vitamin E and those things being others. So that hopefully makes, sense to you. But the other thing I'll say here is that there is one other component here, and this is about socializing and community and happiness in general. One of the things that is, sort of circulating now, and this is speculatory, but certainly is worth mentioning, is that many of these blue zones where people don't get cardiovascular disease to the same degree, yes, they tend to eat a certain way. Yes, they tend to, move a little bit more. They don't have a lot of the Western stuff. But when you look around these blue zones, it's not very clear. But one of the things that is very clear is that the culture is very tight knit. And this is one thing we're starting to look at, connectability. It also may explain some of the reason, who knows, we're speculating now, that why men tend to have higher cardiovascular risk than women, because they tend to, at least in the Western culture, be more isolated. Women tend to have more friends and more community. Men tend to be a little bit more isolated in this. But there's so much about this we don't know. But this is also another component. I hate to say this, but when it comes to cancer, when it comes to cardiovascular disease, certainly we have cardiovascular disease understood a little bit more than cancer, but we also don't know. We don't know, right? We find people all the time who are so healthy who then end up with a heart attack or end up getting diagnosed with cancer or end up with a sickness. And you have to kind of be like, well, what was it? What was it? Was it because they were lonely and stressed out? Was it because they weren't doing enough cardiovascular exercise? Was it because their diet over time wasn't good? Was it a genetic thing that, led to the issue? What was it? So while we don't know, there are many considerations that we can, make sure that we do consider and begin to address. And I hope I've covered sort of those for you. Okay, so last question, and we'll go ahead and call it for today. Jade, I can easily drink up to 80 to 100 grams of organic unsweetened cocoa, hot water, and stevia a week. Is this too much? It helps to calm me at times. Not necessarily. So the question is, that's a lot, right? But I think that ultimately cocoa is really interesting. It's sort of like just like coffee. If your body will tell you if it's too much, and some of the things that you'll get from sort of the increase in some of the compounds in coffee, you'll start getting heart palpitations. You might get blood pressure lowering too much. You might start getting headaches. You might start getting those kinds of things based on the fact that cocoa can lower blood pressure. It also has some stimulants in it. So as long as you're not getting any negative effects, you could, I would say not at all. And the other interesting thing here is, this is an interesting aside, right? This person is saying it calms me down. A lot of people might be like, how can that be? How can it calm you down? And interestingly enough, for many people, coffee can calm them down too. And the reason why is because while coffee and cocoa have stimulants in them, there are many, many, many different compounds, thousands of them, both in coffee and in cocoa. And some of those are very sedating. And so if you have someone, this is where metabolic uniqueness comes in, isn't it? Because you have someone who's a fast oxidizer of caffeine. By the way, Keone and I, my brother and I, we're brothers, but we've had this tested, and I am genetically a fast oxidizer of caffeine. I break it down very quickly. He's a slow oxidizer of caffeine. We did this test, by the way, because we suspected it, because he can't tolerate coffee at all. And I can drink coffee right before going to bed and sleep. And so there are differences here. And so that what's happening here is some of us, let's imagine we're a little bit more sensitive to sort of the sedating qualities of what's in cocoa and coffee. And we basically break down the caffeine faster. That might calm us down a little bit. The other thing about cocoa has anandamide in it and PEA, phenylethylamine. And these two compounds can be euphoric producing. They can make you almost feel like, you know, high to some degree. Like some people may enjoy, you know, almost like a marijuana high. They can almost give you this sort of state of relaxation and focus, especially if you're not being negatively impacted by the other ones. Phenylethylamine is a dopamine mimicker, so it really focuses the brain. And anandamide has been described as chemical bliss. It's, I believe it's a cannabinoid. I could be wrong about that, meaning that it sort of has cannabinoid-like effects. The cannabinoid system was discovered through the study of marijuana. And so cocoa can be very relaxing for people. It's one of the reasons, and it can be, you know, a very nice thing to do. One of the reasons why it's associated with Valentine's Day, which sort of just went by. So I would say you can't necessarily overdo it. Okay. You can't necessarily overdo it. Your body will usually tell you. So hopefully that is helpful for you guys today. We only got through three questions, but the cardiovascular question was such a good one. And we haven't talked about that, and it's such a big deal. I wanted to expand on that. We will start again next week, and I will see you guys then. I'll try to get this up as quick as possible for you. So have a great rest of the day, and be good.
The Metabolic Effect Podcast with Dr. Jade Tita is intended for educational purposes only. Nothing contained on the podcast is intended to create a physician-patient relationship or to replace the services of a licensed, trained physician or health professional, or to be a substitute for medical advice of a physician or trained health professional in your state or country. You should not rely on anything contained on the podcast, and you should make sure you consult a physician licensed in your state or country in all matters relating to your health. Thank you so much.